I think it's recording.
Okay. It says rec on the top and the little red letters.
Does it say that?
Right here. You see? Right there.
Okay.
We'll find out.
Then we'll say that it is. I feel like I'm sitting this way.
Cattywampus.
This is, we're doing a series on spirituality and technology.
Yeah.
And this is actually a test of my spirituality to figure out if I can get the technology to work.
And we don't know.
No.
Just like spirituality, you never know until it's over.
So I feel like I'm leaning down. If you're listening to this, just pretend like everything's perfect. If you're watching it.
Yeah, close your eyes.
And it's leaning towards Reinhardt's, which is an old expression for my family. Mm-hmm. Just lean along with it. Mm-hmm. You should get out more. The idea of this is that we are called in life to live in the real world. And I'm here with one of my favorite people in her backyard. And we're out in the real world, out of the virtual world. Technology is wonderful. It's a gift, but it can be a challenge in lots of different ways. So we're thinking about that. Part of the invitation in this series is how can we bless young people? Because I'm going to talk with, this is Laura Turner, who is my daughter, if you did not know, about technology and spiritual life and parenting and the challenge that poses. Gene Twenge writes and does a ton of research in this area, says that generations are marked not just by the events they go through, like the pandemic, but also by the change of technology. Television shaped a different generation. And there are surveys where parents indicate that the single factor that is making parenting more complicated in our days than any other is technology. Your thoughts? I always love it in an interview where somebody says something.
Nodding along. And your thoughts?
Your thoughts.
Your thoughts, madam?
Your thoughts.
Yes, no, absolutely, 100%. Let's move on. Next question.
Okay.
No, I mean, that makes sense. My kids are not at an age yet where I would say that technology is like the single greatest challenge. Yeah. That's more just, you know, staying in bed all night. Still hard for some of us, but I think that I can see, especially as kids get older and are in their preteen and teenage years, how hard that would be. And I actually do feel thankful a lot of the time that I didn't grow up when social media was a thing in junior high and high school and college. Those times were right with comparison enough that I did not need, and no one needed, you know, more of that.
So I'll get into that in just a minute. Part of the challenge in this series is inviting everybody, think of at least one child for you to bless. And how can this series help to address parents and young people and aunts and uncles? And I think of two young people in my life, one of whom is just two. And we were at a undisclosed location that offered rides on a mechanical buffalo.
Oh, yeah.
But for some reason, the word buffalo did not come to her tongue. And so she says she rode a cantaloupe.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's like the worth and beauty and what is so precious about a little child is such that even in the mistakes and the slip-ups and the falls and the wrong words, there is something indescribably charming about that.
Yes, it's very precious.
And so think about who is the child, who are the young people that you want to bless, and what does that look like in this world that is shaped by technology? Jonathan Haidt, whose book The Anxious Generation has gotten a lot of attention, writes about this. So I'll read a bit of what he wrote, ask for your thoughts, and we'll do that a couple of times.
Okay.
He talks about how the oldest members of Gen Z began puberty around 2009. And as you were saying, that was right when some different trends converged. The rapid spread of high-speed broadband, the arrival of the iPhone in 2007, the new age of hyper-viralized social media, and that was kicked off in 2009 by the arrival of the like button and the retweet or share button. And that transformed, he says, the social dynamics of the online world. Before 2009, social media was most useful as a way to keep up with your friends. So that would have been kind of what you experienced it as when you were going through.
Yeah. Yeah. I think I was a sophomore in college when Facebook became available to us.
Yep. So there were fewer instant and reverberating feedback functions, which he says made it less toxic than it is today. Fourth trend began just a few years later. It hit girls much harder than boys. Mm-hmm. The increased prevalence of posting images of oneself. And that's after smartphones added front-facing cameras. So Gen Z became the first generation in history to go through puberty with a portal in their pockets that called them away from the people nearby and into an alternative universe that was exciting, addictive, unstable, and I'd say, as I will show, unsuitable for children and adolescents. Succeeding socially in that universe required them to devote a large part of their consciousness perpetually to manage what became their online brand. This was now necessary to gain acceptance from peers, which is the oxygen of adolescence, and to avoid online shaming, which is the nightmare of adolescence. Gen Z teens got sucked into spending many hours of each day scrolling through the shiny happy posts of friends, acquaintances, and distant influencers. They watched increasing quantities of user-generated videos and streamed entertainment offered to them by autoplay and algorithms that were designed to keep them online as long as possible. They spent far less time playing with, talking to, touching, or even making eye contact with their friends and families, thereby reducing their participation in embodied social behaviors that are essential for human development. And the core thesis of this book is that what's happened in this last generation that's contributed to so much anxiety is that we are overprotecting children in the real world and underprotecting them in the online world. Your thoughts?
Van, please. Thank you. I think two things come to mind initially in a bit of a contrarian viewpoint. Partly because the book has been everywhere. And that's, I think, a really good thing. But I automatically get suspicious when something's everywhere like that, which probably says more about me than the book. But the first thing is, I think there has often been, and he might talk about this too, actually, kind of a moral panic anytime a new technology comes around. Yeah. So like electricity was going to keep lights on in the home longer.
Speaking of technology, I'm getting a phone call right now.
Oh, yeah. You would actually answer that call somehow from your pocket.
Yeah.
Interesting. That's a wild connection. But this kind of moral panic at times that has come about when there's new technology. So electricity, you know, is available in our homes and all of a sudden we are afraid that people are going to be working at all hours of the day because they can. They don't have to go to bed when, you know, the sky turns dark. And that's true to some degree. That's very true. There's also a lot of good things that have come about because of electricity. There were worries about the printing press and the availability of people to sort of be able to read to themselves or within their own family unit instead of just have, you know, one person in each village or each church be the person who was sort of reading and interpreting scripture over the years. And so I think that's an important thing to kind of hold in the other hand as we consider the really good points that he's making about the smartphone and the like very rapid nature of its change, the way that these companies have sort of studied people to design these things for maximum like interfaceability, you know, just use of or ease of use. And then the other thing is I think there are people who find community online or on social media who might not otherwise find much community at all. And I think of people who have severe disabilities or chronic illnesses where they're not able to do things like leave the house too much on their own or build the kind of community outside that we could. That's important and valuable and doesn't apply to everybody by any means, but I think that that's worth mentioning also. That being said, I absolutely think his premise is right. It seems very like the idea that I would let my son, who is in going into second grade, you know, ride his bike to meet friends or walk to a store by himself, which I was doing not far from his age, feels like it's mind-boggling to me. And partly that's because I think as a society, we've all sort of agreed like, we're not going to let kids do this. We're not going to let them be out alone unless they have an Apple tag in their backpack or, you know, a watch or a phone where I can reach them. And I think it takes a kind of challenge to me as a parent to say, no, actually to build his confidence and his ability to handle things, I have to put him in situations that feel a little scary to me, and that's okay. And then when I think about the digital world, like I grew up with dial up. We had one family computer in the basement. I still remember those. You got mail.
Oh, I thought you were imitating me.
Oh, well,
yeah,
I usually am.
I know.
And I think about like the ways that that evolves so quickly. And I know, you know, nothing. And I can do all these good things. And, you know, I think Jonathan Haidt has endorsed wait until eighth, which is like a really good idea that says until eighth grade, your kid doesn't have a phone, might have a watch or something. But like those are all important. But there will be things that I'm just super unaware of as he grows up. And so thinking about that feels really important too, and a little scary in the reverse way. Like, do I really want to know what goes on the internet right now? I just every day I feel like you hear more and more horrors of like terrible videos and images and stories and things that people happen upon. And I kind of am okay living in ignorance sometimes.
Yeah.
And I have to get beyond that and dive in to see things before my kids will.
Yeah.
And I don't even know where to start in some ways.
I'll read a little bit more of what he actually talks about. What happened right around 2010 is the great rewiring, when online technology has begun to kind of rewire the brains of our children. And he talks about four features about the real world that are different from the online world. One is that in the real world, interactions are embodied. So we use our bodies to communicate.
Yeah.
And we read each other's faces and tone of voice and so on. Secondly, they're synchronous, which means they're happening at the same time. And so that teaches about timing. I have to learn, what have you done? And am I actually listening to you or just waiting until I can say the next clever thing that I can say?
Some people who grew up in the 1950s still haven't learned that one, apparently.
Turn taking.
Jonathan Haidt.
And then they involve primarily one-to-one or one-to-several communications with only one interaction happening at a given moment. So if you're talking, then I'm supposed to be quiet. And then they take place in communities that have what he calls a high bar for entry and exit. Like, we're sitting here, we're going to be talking, we're in the family. It would be painful for our relationship to fall apart. That can happen, and it does, and it is painful. But online, those all tend to be different. Those interactions tend to be not embodied. Often, I might post something and you would respond to it later on, so they're not at the same time.
Yeah.
They're often not one-on-one. In fact, I want to get as many responses as I can. And it's actually often quite easy for me to leave this particular group and join some other group. And so, your thoughts?
This interface is great.
Yeah.
Yeah. My thought, wow, this is so wide-ranging. There's a prayer I really love, and I was listening to a version of it this morning. It's just called The Welcome Prayer by Father Thomas Keating, who was a Catholic, you know, father. And it kind of is a prayer to let go of the desire for affection, pleasure, a few other things. I surrender kind of my desire for control, power, affection, and pleasure. I surrender my desire to change other people, other circumstances, and even myself. I welcome everything that comes to me today as for my own healing, which is its own beautiful prayer. And I think worth reading if any of you haven't read it.
We'll try to post that or do something to make it available.
Yeah, try that. Try to do that. Try to get that right. Good luck. There's a PDF online. I'll send it to you.
Thank you.
But I think about that because I think about so much of being online. And what you start to learn early, especially on social media, is that you can control everything around you.
Yeah.
And you can control, you know, not being embodied. You can control, I'm going to speak this out on a megaphone to however many people follow me, or I'm going to try to share something engaging or provocative or controversial so it will get more engagement. I can try to, you know, take the time to read things when I want to read them, or interact with them when I want to, which might be all day long or might be rarely, depending on the person. And so this idea that, like, as Christians especially, we can and should control everything, and then also control you know, maybe I took 100 pictures, but there's one that I like and I change it enough so that I feel good about myself and the self I present to the world, especially when I think about younger girls and, you know, they're already under so much pressure to present to the world in a very certain way. And the idea that you get reinforcement for tightly controlling whatever you say that's on message, however you look that's acceptable, you know, it's human to want that. And I think that's part of this that's important is like the desire for what we get from social media isn't a bad desire. In fact, it's there because God placed it in us. We want community. We want relationships. We want to be heard and taken seriously. We want to be understood and not misinterpreted. We want to be seen for who we feel ourselves to be inside that might be harder to communicate outside. But the like poison in it is that we're just kind of grasping at straws to try to control something that can't be controlled. And I think that's why I know when I spend, you know, an hour looking through things on Instagram, I come away just feeling like worse about myself. Yeah. Everyone else is having a better time. Everyone else's kids are better behaved. Everybody else is in better shape. Everyone else can do more, has more money. Like, yeah. That's not a great.
No.
It doesn't stop me from doing it, but it's not a great feeling. And I'm 40. So the thought of like younger people who are just forming their sense of the world,
sense of self.
I kind of bounce back a little bit because I can fact check it against other things. But if you don't have that, that's harder.
How do you deal as a parent with your kids' feelings around that? Like even at the age of your kids, screen time is a prized commodity.
Yeah.
And saying, nope, no more screen time. And I know there's times when one of your kids will be able to figure out how to go on YouTube and see something if I'm with them.
Oh, yeah.
That he wants to see. But then you'll say, no. If you go on YouTube, you have access to all other kinds of stuff.
Yeah.
So you have to monitor that. You have to live already, and it will probably grow with moments where you know you'll be the good guy if you say yes. You'll be the bad guy if you say no. But love would lead you to have to say no sometimes. How do you navigate that?
Yeah, I think about, I think part of the thing that I actually have probably too easy of a time saying no, to the point that I would say no to something that might be fun and enjoyable for a kid to watch and appropriate for them at the end of a long day when, you know, whatever, to watch a short video of guys making trick shots into a basketball. With YouTube, the rule is and will be for a very long time, you only can do that with an adult around you. So I put in search terms. I'm sitting with you watching it. It's not something you can do on your own. I think Jonathan Haidt has actually written about this, which I kind of love, the idea that not all screen time is bad. I mean, we grew up in a family that loved movies and watched a lot of movies, watched a lot of fun shows, watched a lot of terrible movies. I watched Psycho when I was 9 years old. Turned out great. But I think that like those are fun memories that I have. And so I think he's written about if you're, you know, watching something that's a story and there's a kind of like moral to it or a lesson you can draw from it about life. And particularly if you're watching it with family members and or friends, that's great. And I think about my kid watching Cars with his friends. Like I have memories of just seeing him with his buddies watching movies and cheering for the good guy. And I just think that's so fun. Or finding out my son likes John Wayne movies, which I never would have guessed seven. He does. And I wouldn't trade that for anything because I think stories are a really important part of how we make sense of the world. And movies are a great part of storytelling in the culture that we live in.
Yeah.
Shows like Super Kitties are, you know, what my daughter's into. And it's awful. But I like to watch TV at the end of a long day. Like a kid, I get it. Sometimes you need that.
One other question. I'm really struck by, and I admire a lot how you and Zach, your husband, have a community of friends that is really, really tight. And you're kind of raising your kids together. And I think about, there are children, none that we had, but there are children who will complain, oh, everybody else is doing this, or it's not fair because you're saying no to me and they get to do this.
Yeah.
Do you guys talk together about, as you're raising your kids, kind of technology, screen time, when do they get a phone? One of the things that Jonathan writes about is it can be easier if you have a community of parents where you're actually landing on some guidelines together that can reinforce that community. And the isolationism of our day is part of what makes it harder often.
Yeah, I think that's
your
so
thoughts.
True. Thank you. I almost didn't share my thoughts. I wouldn't have if you hadn't prompted me. I think that's really true because doing this in a vacuum would be so hard. I have a few friends who whose kids go to a school where it's just very normal for fourth, fifth, and sixth graders to have phones. And it's much harder for those families to keep saying no to their kids, especially because their kids are using their friends' phones during the day. That's just what they do. And yes, I do. We talk fairly freely and openly with these friends about our choices. I think we've all, we haven't like formally made commitments to wait till eighth grade, but I think we're all on board with that. And we'll have that conversation as our kids get older. A couple of these families have recently actually got home phones, which I kind of love. And I think we're about to do that. Yeah.
Wow.
So then their kids have to learn the practice, which we did as kids, of calling and saying, you know, hello, Mr. Ortberg, is Laura there? And yes, this is Harvey. And can I talk to Chance? And I think that's kind of cool. They do a lot of prank calling too, which I actually also think is great. I think that's like a very important kid skill to learn, a prank call. But it does make life a lot easier to be able to do it with other people, to say no and hold that line if you know you're not the only one kind of holding out on your kid, and then to find rich ways to pass time. So when I'm when we're together with our friends, there will be movies on occasionally or sports games for the kids, but no one's like on an iPad. No one's having like their individual screen time. Like all the kids have to be bored together, and that's okay.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah. No, boredom is such a key part of life and of childhood.
Yeah. You don't have to tell me twice.
So.
Become new.
I think we'll end it there.
Yeah.
Anything else you want to say either to parents or young women that are wrestling with what they see of their lives when they compare it to other people online? Doesn't have to be, but just anything else
you want to say? No, I mean, I think just it's all fake. Like, we're all just trying to show our best selves all the time.
Yeah.
And that's not real life. And you know, I think we all kind of know that. But the less we can do that with our kids, especially, the better place the world will be, I think, and that God is in that like welcoming surrender.
I have just been talking to my sister about that in very deep ways, about feeling that fear of, but if it's the real me, who wants to see that? Who wants to be with that? And but there is no other way to be loved by God or be loved by another person. So it's worth trying to take the risk and learn it.
It is.
Thank you. You should get out more. Love you.
See ya.
Hey, thanks for joining us. Be sure to subscribe so you don't miss any future episodes from John. You can also visit our website, becomenew.com, to access all of our videos there or subscribe for the emails that go with each video. But my personal favorite way to stay in the loop with Become New is by text. We will send you a text message every morning that we release a new video, with the title of that video and just the link to the video. So if you want that, you can text the word BECOME to the number 855-888-0444 and we'll get those messages to you. If you've got a prayer request, there's a group of us who meet each weekday, Monday through Friday, for 1 hour to pray for viewers just like yourself. So you can text or email us your prayer request at 855-888-0444 or at connect@becomenew.com. Remember, the most important thing about your life is the person you become. We'll see you next time.